Thank you for joining us on the Travel Royally podcast. We have a great podcast for you today. This podcast is sponsored by Royal Links Golf Tours. If you're ready to start your golf vacation and start planning, visit us at royallinksgolftours.com and fill out that vacation customization form. Please enjoy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Travel Royally podcast. Today, it's our distinct pleasure to welcome to the Travel Royally podcast Tom Coyne. Tom's the author of 5 books, including A Gentleman's Game, Paper Tiger, A Course Called Ireland, A Course Called Scotland, and A Course Called America. His first book, A Gentleman's Game, was made into a motion picture that starred Gary Sinise. Tom's a former associate professor of English at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, and he's a founder of the Broken Tea Society, of which I'm a proud member, and he's also the editor of their magazine, The Golfer's Journal. Now, The Golfer's Journal is an amazing quarterly publication. We encourage everyone to subscribe. It's full of wonderful writing, brilliant photography, and all of that makes the stories all the more gripping. He also hosts a wonderful podcast called The Golfer's Journal, where he has top-flight guests. We encourage you to watch that. We met Tom through our ambassador in Scotland, Alan McPherson, who was Tom's caddy in East Lothian when he attempted to qualify for the Open Championship. So, Tom, welcome to the Travel Royally podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. Great to be here.
Well, we should probably start with Alan, actually. He's played every golf course in Scotland.
Yes.
For charity. And when people land in Edinburgh, he's our ambassador. He greets everyone, makes sure they get off to a safe start, either by handing them off to our driver or by getting them to the van rental. But he's just a wonderful human being.
You couldn't start your trip any better than with Alan, no doubt about it. And the funny thing is, when I was doing A Course Called Scotland, you know, and it's this crazy adventure to try and play every links in Scotland. And, you know, Alan had, there had been some correspondence, but it was our connecting. There was still some sort of luck and happenstance to it. I think he knew I was coming in and I wasn't sure if I was going to. Anyway, it was a fortunate crossing of paths when we went out and played the Glen Golf Club in North Berwick, the North Berwick East Links, and had a great day and got to know him. And I thought, you know, that quest of mine was going to end qualifying for the Open Championship. And, you know, a part of the story was like thinking about, all right, who's going to caddy for me? But once I met Alan, and obviously two kindred spirits chasing, I'll never get near his number of Scottish courses played. But there was no doubt Alan was going to be the guy on my bag, and it's been wonderful to remain friends. And I'm looking forward to actually, this year getting to play some golf with him again.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about the friends that are made, but people like Alan, as you said, they're just happenstance, kind of good luck that you run into them. Whether you're in Ireland or Scotland, and we go to England and Wales as well, I've got friends that I've met through golf that are lifelong friends and have enriched my life immeasurably. So,
yeah, no doubt about it. That's the best part of doing this, right? It's the people. I've certainly gotten to a point where, you know, I've been fortunate to play a lot of places doing this and wherever it is. But, you know, I'm not chasing lists anymore or bucket list golf courses. You know, I'm really more interested in the people that I get to spend the time with.
Well, with your business, Coyne Golf, and with Royal Links Golf Tours, I know that you get some of the same types of clients we get, that I know the no laying up guys call them bag tag Barrys, where they just want to play the big name courses. And I think my experience, and certainly your experience, has been that some of the most fun are at places like the Glen Golf Club or Ardglass, or places like that that are off. They are kind of off the beaten path in terms of the minds of golfers, but those are some of the most fun places I've ever played.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think, you know, that's why, you know, in doing the Ireland book, the Scotland book, There are plenty. There's been plenty of great stuff written about, you know, the big name courses, and in Ireland and the British Isles, and it was sort of, you know, my goal and my what I wanted to accomplish in those stories is to find places that maybe people hadn't been, find special places that they would go that they wouldn't go otherwise, and try to make those places sort of come to life in the story. So, yeah, in the Ireland book, I mean, Ardglass was a blessing to find Ardglass when, you know, obviously it's overshadowed by Royal County down up, right, you know, up the road. But it's become, you know, I'm a life member there. It's become one of my favorite places in golf, and the same for Carn on the west coast of Ireland, which is a little remote to be on too many itineraries, but yeah. It's so worth the trip. Probably my favorite place to be, just period. And there aren't any better people in the world.
Which is why I put this photo behind me. This was in your honor.
I recognize
Darren up
that.
There just for you.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, well, it's such a special place.
It really is. My favorite over that way is Enniscrone. I think that's just an amazing place. But let's start at the beginning with you. How did your love affair with golf start?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up around golf. My brother, older brother, was a pretty good player. And my dad played and was a member at a course here outside Philadelphia called Rolling Green, which is a great old William Flynn course. And so I started, you know, going up to the junior clinics when I was 8, 9 years old, and then started caddying there when I was 12. And that's probably the biggest, you know, really cemented my connection to golf, was as a caddy. You know, that's where, and especially I think that had a big impact on my life as a writer, where, you know, being a caddy, you really learn to understand people, you learn how to talk to people, the stories you get to hear and the experiences you have are, you know, exceptional and wild and crazy. I mean, the best storytellers I've ever known are the caddies I worked right. with. And that was hugely important, to my life. I mean, so I caddied from the ages of 12, like all the way through graduate school. Yeah. It's the only other job I really had. So I would say like caddying was my entry point to golf. I mean, I was fortunate that my dad, you know, he was also a member at the course where I caddied. So in the afternoon or in the evenings, I would go out and play. So it was like Rolling Green was my summer camp. You know, I was there from sunup to sundown all day, every day, you know, in the summertime, in the spring, in the fall. And it was just, and I fell in love with it. I didn't expect to connect it to writing, but that was a, you know, when I started writing a novel about caddies many years later, it was a happy accident.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine, I live here in Atlanta, and a friend of mine played Rolling Green last fall. And I said, what'd you think of it? And he said, it'd be a wonderful course if they cut down 1,000 trees, cut the rough back. And he thought it was a little narrow. And
well, he needs to come back because they took down all the trees.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. And you can see, you see it, the Rolling Green. You can see, I think from the fifth tee, you can almost see the entire golf course or the wow. fourth green. So yeah, it's wildly transformed. But yeah, I grew up, you know, punching out of those trees, and now they're gone. But I think, you know, the now you really can appreciate the scope of the place, and the land movement is what makes it so exceptional.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I want to move on to your writing. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
And there are, you know, when I think of writers that I've enjoyed, I remember the opening line to Moby Dick as an example. And Kurt Vonnegut had a catchphrase in Slaughterhouse-Five, and so it goes. And I was reading some of your writing the other day, and it literally stopped me in my tracks. I mean, I reread the sentence 3 or 4 times, and I'm like, this is just brilliant writing. And to you, it's probably an innocuous sentence, you know, in a 10,000 word article, or I don't even remember if it was, I don't remember if it was a book, but I remember just reading it going, holy cow, it just hit me. So who was your biggest influence as a writer?
Well, thanks for saying that. And no, I mean, I kind of sweat over every sentence, so no innocuous sentences. And I really appreciate that feedback, because I think when I think about influences as a writer, it was really the writers whose sentences were so precise that right, you would spend, you know, 20 minutes like pondering a single sentence, and whether that's Fitzgerald or Hemingway. For me, I was largely influenced by influenced or inspired, I guess, by writers like Raymond Carver and Tim O'Brien, who are, you know, huge in the 70s and 80s and still are, but Raymond Carver, God rest his soul. But in any event, they were writers. They just wrote such precise lyrical sentences, where the language wasn't trying to overpower you in terms of the diction or vocabulary, but it all added up to something immensely powerful. And I think that, so like writers like that just sort of showed you that, like, this is about the pieces, you know, the precision and the accuracy and the cadence, that you build paragraphs from sentences, you build sentences from words. I had to like learn plot and pace, all that stuff, like much later, or maybe that was just something growing up listening to Caddies that I had a sense for how stories should work. But you know, going through graduate school and undergrad, it was all about like, I just wanted to write, I wanted to write good sentences. And it's and it seems like a simple thing, but it's actually it's quite challenging, and to do it in a short form, like Raymond Carver did, and with stories that look like they were just built so simply but could still break your heart. You kind of learn that that's very difficult. It makes it look, makes writing look easy, and probably made me believe that I could give it a shot. Then you realize that's actually, it's very hard to do more with less.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember a writer, I don't know if you've heard of him. You're certainly familiar with a book of his that was made into a movie, W.P. Kinsella.
Of course, yeah.
I read everything he wrote in the late 70s and early 80s before Field of Dreams was made. I loved his writing. But, you know, I think the other thing, Tom, we talk about golf writers of the past as though that was the golden age. You know, Charles Darwin, mm-hmm. Henry Longhurst, P.G. Wodehouse. I mean, there are tons of writers back then. And I almost feel like today we've got just an amazing number of great golf writers. And I would put you in there with Michael Bamberger and others that whose writing just enthralls people, including me.
Well, thank you. No, it's that's very generous of you to say. Always great to be mentioned in Michael's company. He's been a good friend, and is a Philadelphia guy as well. And we've sort of interestingly followed each other through three different publishing houses, actually, along the way, where we've landed, which is probably not too much of a coincidence, because there aren't so many editors out there looking for golf. So maybe not totally accidental, but Michael is wonderful. And yeah, like you said, there's, you know, there's such a great, rich legacy of golf writing. I mean, George Plimpton, I guess, talked about, you know, the smaller the ball, the better the writing. Yeah. And he was he wrote some great golf stuff as well. But it's interesting, you know, when you go back and in the Golfer's Journal, we've done stuff on Darwin and those pieces, how they, well, it's always interesting to read them in terms of like golfers we're still thinking about or worried about the same stuff that we think or worry about today, which is kind of timeless. And then they also just their diction, like, just takes you back in a little bit of a time machine to golf's roots, certainly in this country. So it's always always fun to look back.
Well, some of the people that came before you more recently would have been people like John Updike, mm-hmm. Dan Jenkins, the dogged victims of inexorable fate. I mean, he's another one who captivated me. And a neighbor of yours in Philadelphia, I say neighbor, but James Finnegan was
yeah.
when I read his books, it felt like you were there, right? I mean, it was literally like watching a movie. It was so descriptive, so colorful, so lovingly written, so thoughtful, just amazing to me.
He was a great man. And yeah, wrote beautiful books and was certainly an inspiration to me. And on the few, you know, I got to know him later in his life. And he was just incredibly generous and encouraging of me. And we write very differently, but I think, you know, he still, you know, really did encourage and appreciate what I was trying to do. I probably used some words he wouldn't use.
Right.
But just a true gentleman. And man, he loved golf.
Think in some way his books, I know in my case, inspired me to want to go to all those courses that he so lovingly described?
Oh, there's no, they should inspire you to go. I would, if you read those books. I mean, I didn't look at them until later, until I'd already sort of been and done my trips, and so they would have inspired me even more to do them. I would say, you know, and it's because it's funny, like I read so much, or I spend so much time thinking about golf, or writing golf, or reading golf for the Golfer's Journal, or seeing what other golf writers are doing, that like when I have the chance to sit down with a book, like it's almost, well, in fact, it's never a golf book, to just sort of give my brain some free space and also be thinking of writing outside of golf, because I think the best golf writing is just good writing, right?
Right.
And I think sometimes, you know, I feel like golf writers, now that I read more pitches than I've ever sort of read before as editor, that it can be a bit of a limiting thing to sort of put golf on golf writing. Because oftentimes then like the focus is on, ah, look at the golf I'm talking about. Isn't the golf great? And that's fine. But we want great writing. I mean, golf is the best backdrop. And probably the best backdrop in sports for storytelling. I mean, you have so much, you have setting, you have character, your conflict, you have emotional interior and exterior stories. There's so much to play with.
Yeah.
But you got to get the right, you've got to get the nuts and bolts right. And, and sometimes I think you do find that in golf books. But I think, you know, you can find that in the literary world at large as well.
Well, I think that's true in all your writing, even though, you know, the five books that I mentioned are all golf themed. It's more about the characters and their experiences and your interaction with them. And when I think about, you know, your first book, A Gentleman's Game, I mean, I see that more of a, I hate to use this phrase, but a coming of age with golf as the backdrop.
Oh, it's definitely my coming of age story. You know, I think probably most authors start off with a coming of age novel, or a lot do, whether they ever show it to anyone or not, you know, or it gets out there. But that's what A Gentleman's Game was. I mean, I was 23 when I wrote it, so I didn't know much about anything.
Right.
Probably still don't, but I really didn't know anything then. All I knew were the experiences and what I thought about the world as a young person growing up.
Right.
And so that's my growing up at a country club story. And it was actually my thesis in graduate school. My first priority for it was just finish it so I could get my master's. And then for it to go on and sort of have a life of its own was, it made my mind spin. It was wild.
Yeah, tell us a story about that, because it's wild that was your master's thesis.
Yeah.
You know, the following year it gets turned into a movie.
Nuts. Totally nuts. So yeah, it started off as just a series of short stories about caddies. And this kid who was a golf prodigy, whose dad was a member at the club. I was not a golf prodigy, but it was fun to imagine myself in that role, because it's a book written in the first person. The character's name is Timmy Price, so there's like a play on my own name there. And
right.
So, I mean, the events and the characters are fictional, but, you know, the emotions of growing up in that world were something that I could access. So these stories started coming together into chapters. And then I suddenly had, you know, this big pile of pages that I called a novel and gave to my thesis advisor. And she said, wait, I think you actually have something here. So worked on it for a few months after finishing my master's, and then, you know, sent it out to literary agents and went up to a party in New York with a backpack full of manuscripts and crashed a publishing party and found an agent and was like, you've got to read this. And he did. And he's been my agent ever since, Dan Mandel. We've been on this great journey together. And so getting signed up at that point, I guess I was 24 at that point, you know, with a major New York literary agency. I mean, this is the agency that, you know, published Kafka. That's how they started.
Yeah.
So it was like, it's called Sanford Greenberger. So that was like, I mean, I'm living at home with my parents and I suddenly I have an agent and we're going out with a book and he gets a book deal for me. And then about 3 weeks after that, I got a phone call from LA telling me, or Dan called me to tell me that this producer from Warner Brothers wants to talk to you. And I'm like, what? You know, there's no, how do they even see the book? And I had no idea how that whole thing worked with film scouts looking for literary material. But yeah, the producer Mills Goodloe called and said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I was like, I'm nothing. What are you doing? And he said, well, I'm flying to Philadelphia and I'm going to tell you, play golf with you. And we're going to tell you how we're going to make this movie. So that's what happened. And he did. And in fairness, you know, I've since learned that Hollywood doesn't always deliver on its right. promises. I've learned that lesson several times. But credit to Mills. He got it made. And it was, you know, and I got, you know, to be a co-producer and be on the set all the time. And they filmed a lot of it at Rolling Green.
And at your parents' home, right? Your childhood home.
Yeah, they filmed a big chunk of it. Well, we were looking for homes to shoot at and we were doing location scouting. And at one point, you know, I was like, can you drop me off at my house? I don't know, even know if I had a car at the time. And the location scout and the director were like, this place looks like the place in the story. I was like, well, no kidding. That's not an accident.
No
so
shit. Like,
well, what if we, yeah, no, yeah, no shit. So, like, you think we could use it? So, my parents generously turned over their home for a summer while it got repainted and remodeled, like filled with different furniture and all that fun stuff, and became a movie set for 6 weeks, for about a month. Yeah.
Well, don't you think, and maybe this is what you were alluding to, that A Course Called Ireland would be a great movie?
Yes. So I think it would be a great something, and I wish I could talk more about that right now. But
okay, great.
I'd say that, like, for these stories becoming cinematic in one way or another, there may be life for them yet.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, I think you're probably best known, seems to me, for your book, or books, I should say, based in Ireland and Scotland. What spurred you to write those two books, and how did you remain married during that time?
Yeah, that's the question I get most often when I do a lot of speaking at, you know, golf clubs and corporate events and stuff like that. And it's always the first question. Are you still married? Or does your wife have a sister? That kind of those questions, which are understandable questions.
Yeah.
Allison is she's the best and has been the rock of keeping our lives going forward while I'm off on these tangents and boondoggles and going on these wild adventures. But it's been cool for her to experience a lot of them with me as well. And
yeah.
And now that we have girls, they're pretty well traveled because of some of the stuff that we've been lucky to do. But the idea of doing it, I mean, I sort of transitioned to nonfiction with Paper Tiger, where I tried to play pro golf, and then and I liked that world, and Paper Tiger kind of proved, okay, I can write a story about myself in a creative way that feels and reads like a novel, but I can go out and create an adventure And I'd been going to play golf and visiting Ireland for years, since I was in high school with my dad. And I think I was approaching, I was almost 30 at the time, and was putting together a golf itinerary for my friends. And, you know, was looking at a golf map of Ireland and sort of was like, wow, it's just, you know, Ireland is just ringed with these links courses. And so, like, which corner or which quadrant do we go to? And there were many on there that I hadn't been to yet. And I thought, well, what if this is a book? And, you know, speaking of inspirations, I would say that Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods was definitely an inspiration for, you know, I think his nonfiction and travel storytelling and talking about place and people, he's as good as they get. So, there was, so the idea was that, okay, I'll go play Ireland like one big golf course and I'll, and it wasn't completely because of a walk in the woods why I walked it. The idea there was that you don't take golf carts in Ireland. So if I was going to play Ireland as one sort of continuous loop of golf holes, that I should do it on foot. I'm glad I did. You know, it took 4 months, 1,100 miles, about 30 pounds lost along the way. But it meant that I had to sort of stop in places that you wouldn't necessarily stop. You know, I had a 20-mile leash every day. You know, I had to stop in towns where the tour buses would pass through or wouldn't even get near, and find rooms in places where people weren't usually looking for a room.
Right.
And that just, I think, helped me get to know Ireland and its people maybe in a pretty intimate way. That hopefully, like you said, you know, I don't think of that story as a golf book. Golf is the trajectory and it took me to all these great places. But it's hopefully a book about Ireland and its people. Because they're really what populates the pages.
Right. Absolutely. Your experiences were amazing to me. And, some were hilarious. Do you have plans for another book or books?
So we did, you know, Ireland, Scotland, then I did America. And when I finished doing America, which was, you know, all 50 states and took me 8 months to do that one. I was like, okay, the travel series is done. And you know, I could do Australia, but I need to get down there, but I don't know if it's going to be a book. But about a year and a half ago, I got a message from a superintendent at a 9-hole golf course in the Catskills, asking me if I'd like to come check the place out, that it was going up on the market, it was going to close, it was 100 years old, and maybe it's something I want to write about, or new people in golf who could be helpful. So at the time I had a book deal, but I had no subject. I just had a book deal with my publisher for a golf book.
Yeah.
And was looking for ideas, and I thought, hey, this is kind of interesting. You know, I definitely sort of believe in like being open to what the universe sort of throws at you. And the more open, the more you can say yes versus no.
Right.
The better off you're going to be. So I went up and looked at it and couldn't see much because it was under ice and snow. But I met the superintendent, and his name's Sean Smith. And his passion for the place and his love of the area, I said, well, we've got a story here, you know. So I worked out a deal where I became the owner operator for 1 year. It's so sort of like, you know, pitching it to my publisher, like, that's like, we bought a zoo. Like, I'm going to go run a golf course for a year and see what it's like, because, you know, my whole life I've been a taker of golf. And now is my chance to try and be a provider. So that's what I did for the last, since last March, you know, worked out the contracts, got on a mower, started working with Sean, running the pro shop, having a staff, doing, you know, becoming a manager, owner, operator of a property. It's been insane. And the interesting thing about this book is that it's just getting longer because we've decided to stay on as the owners, and the next chapter, literally the next chapter of the book is, as we renovate the golf course, which is happening right now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's nuts.
Do you have partners in the ownership or is it you outright?
No, I have some partners. The original owners, staying involved because they weren't the original owners. They bought it to develop the property and bring it, try and do some different things, but they weren't golf people. So they're hospitality side. So they're going to handle the food and beverage, and we put a new restaurant in. That's how all happening right now, which is great. And we have 100 extra acres there that they can sort of develop a little bit to help offset the investment. I mean, you can only make so much of golf money on a 9-hole golf course, but Bill Murray is one of my partners that came in to I guess you'd say on the golf side to buy the golf course, and Mike Madden, who people will know from the Madden golf, the Madden football family. Right. He's John Madden's son. So two great guys who believed in who are golf crazy. And crazy enough to get into the golf business with me. So
that's fantastic. I can't wait to come play it.
Well, you have to.
Yeah,
it's a total charmer. And we're clearing about 15 acres right now. I mean, the place is 100 years and it hadn't been touched, and in a good way. You know, the grass is, there's like ancient strands of grass out there. It's very, very cool. And we're not going to sort of change the character, but it was overgrown and the trees are, you know, they're dying because at 100 trees, a lot of species tend to die. So doing some clearing, moving a couple things so that we can take advantage of the fact that we are on the side of a mountain and take some of the really, there are a couple weak notes that we can use for like a driving range and stuff like that. So improving it all across the board. It's going to have great food, a great hangout vibe. No tee times. It's couldn't be less expensive. Hardly, you know, we're talking, you know, $25 tee times and just bring your dog and go have a good time. So it's great.
That's amazing. Well, I want to move on to, the Broken Tee Society. I mentioned at the outset that I'm a member. I love being a member. How did the Broken Tee Society come to be? Not just the Broken Tee Society, but the Golfers Journal as well, the magazine.
Yeah, well, thank you for being a member and supporting the Golfers Journal. Like you said, I mean, we don't call our subscribers. We think of them as members because there's a lot that goes with subscribing to the Golfers Journal that's sort of beyond getting a book. I mean, but where it started, it grew out of the Surfers Journal, which is why we're based in San Clemente, California, near one of the great breaks in California. Yeah. And the Surfers Journal had been around forever and has a huge following but you know, is committed to, you know, really long form storytelling, beautiful photography, etc. So our publisher, Brendan Thomas, got involved with the Surfers Journal. He's from South Africa, but he's a surfer, but also a big golfer. So he thought about, okay, what if we can do this for golf? And what this was like, okay, a very commercially quiet experience, almost no ads,
right?
Real storytelling, long form writing, really, you know, try and have the best photography, and sort of like do the opposite of what every other golf magazine was doing at the time. And produce what we think of as a book. You know, it's not cheap, but once you hold it and look at it, you can tell, okay, this wasn't cheap to make either.
It's a collectible.
It is. That's the idea. I mean, we felt like, I know Brendan felt like if we create something that people will collect, then we'll stick around for a while. And gratefully, I mean, that's what it's become. We're working on, I mean, let's see, 27, I guess just number 27 just landed in people's books.
I can't see it.
Ah, you've got the
I can't see it with my background.
You can't see it in your background.
Yeah, I think Tom, the great thing about this is issue 27, and you mentioned it's not like other golf magazines. Gratefully, it's not that. And I think the number one thing that makes it attractive beyond the writing and the stories and the photography is the unpredictability. When you get it, you have no idea what's inside. And when you think about it, I can tell you right now that in March, every, you know, Golf and Golf Digest are going to publish a Masters issue. Mm-hmm. The next month, it'll be PGA and so forth. In the fall, they do new product reviews. It's completely predictable. And it's golf has moved, golf magazines and golf writing have moved beyond the predictability of the old standards where you know exactly what's coming. And, you know, when you think about it, they still have a lot of golf instruction in those magazines. And I think the vast majority of people, if they're looking for immediate help in a golf swing, aren't waiting for the next issue of a magazine. They're going to YouTube to right. try and find someone that can help them with their slice or their over their top move or whatever their issue is.
Yeah. So
it's completely unpredictable, which is, and the stories inside aren't connected. I mean, they're connected with a thread of golf, but when I looked at today, the issue I got today, I didn't have a chance to read it, but I looked at the titles and they're disparate ideas that, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's the hope, right? I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, we're trying to tell the stories of golf in all its forms, right? So, I mean, in any issue of the Golfer's Journal, you're going to get, like, in 27, you're going to get some real history with Alexis Sterling's story, and you know that'll appeal to, you know, if you're into hardcore golf history, but then you're also going to get, you know, the story of guy, you know, a group of golfers playing in you know, this movement in LA where golf is tied to sort of like fashion and cool young hip culture. You're going to get a story from Scotland at Anstruther, which you mentioned earlier,
right.
and from a great, wonderful player and writer who grew up there. So yeah, that's the unpredictability of it is key. And it's probably just a side effect of the fact that, like, if we're looking at a story and it feels like it would fit really well in some other publication, then it's probably not right for us. And there's nothing wrong with those publications. It's just right. that we need to differentiate ourselves. So no, we don't do an instruction in the book. We don't do you know, like, we don't do rankings in the book and stuff like that. You know, we're trying to create something. That book to me is like kind of like, I don't know, I don't want to be like too sanctimonious about it, but it's a little bit sacred for me, and I know for you know, our publisher and our whole edit team, you know, that we only want stuff in there that is going to stand the test of some time,
right.
That someone can pick it up in 10, 20 years from now and it still have some impact on them. Yeah. It's not easy to find those stories, but, you know, 4 times a year so far, so good. In the other products, you know, like in the, we have a server, like a virtual clubhouse on Discord for the Broken right. Tea Society members. We have the podcasts where, you know, we can be more topical, or we can have topics on game improvement, and people can, and we can move this way and that way and be a little more current or whatever. But,
yeah.
You know, the book should feel timeless, and that's the hope.
Well, I think there was a bridge between golf and Golf Digest and what you're doing. And for me, it was Lynx Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to get that today, and I, you know, I love George Pepper's writing, and he doesn't write as much anymore, but he's got a fantastic story as well. But
yeah, George, I'm looking at a on my wall here. I think maybe my first cover story was about an Irish golf trip in Lynx Magazine. So George was very kind and generous to me over the years as well, and supportive, and yeah, no, he's fantastic and a great person, has lived such an extraordinary golf life.
Yeah.
If he wasn't with Lynx, I would love to do his profile in the Golfer's Journal. Maybe we'll get there.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get there someday for sure.
Well, hey, we love your podcast. I mean, I listen to it religiously, and first I want to talk. I want to mention another. You're great on podcasts in general. And I heard you with Gary Williams, and that was a very moving story from the two of you. And I just wanted to congratulate you on that. It was, I'm sure that touched a lot of people, the story from both of you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, I started talking about my sobriety in the Scotland book, and, yeah. But not without like a lot of thought, and it wasn't something I'd like casually did, and consulted with a lot of people, and just deciding, you know, if I'm going to be someone who talks about my life and my adventures and my journey. Like, there's no way to not talk about the fact that none of this would be happening or be possible for me if I still drank. So, so I've been pretty comfortable talking about it since then, and it was great to talk to Gary about his journey. And you know, there's so many people in golf who have gone down the path to recovery, or want to go down the path to recovery, or want to make a change, or aren't sure. You know, so it's been really nice just to hear from people, frankly, all over the world, who are in golf, and I'm not any sort of spokesperson for sobriety or anything like that. I'm just a guy who had to stop, and and it's been cool to relate to a lot of other people on that level. It's a special bond, and Gary's one of the great people in golf. So it's you know, it's fun when you discover that connection that you have with people. And you find it all the time. We don't wear shirts around saying like sober, every once in a while you're out somewhere and you're like, hey, I'm one of, you know, we're on the same team there or something. It's very cool.
That's very cool. You know, I think my favorite podcast that you did for the Golfers Journal, though, was the one with Bill Murray, where you're driving through the rural South to go to Ohoopee Match Club.
Yeah.
He's a wild man. I mean, it seems like he's completely spontaneous.
Bill's definitely spontaneous. Yeah. Nothing happening on that recording. Which he was kind to do. In fact, he brought it up. We were driving and I'd asked him to be on the podcast, I think a couple times. And he's like, hey, do you want to do it now? We had, you know, whatever, a 3-hour drive ahead of us. And I thankfully, you know, I had my microphones ready to go. So everything on there is just like what it's like to be in a car for a couple hours with Bill Murray, which is a spontaneous experience. Yes. If Bill, you know, sees something interesting, he's usually going to stop and check it out, which is actually quite a nice way to live. Bill is I think spontaneous by nature, and but also like is really golf crazy, like is just really loves golf and is very competitive and is a grinder and loves to play, and so that's I think where like we've connected is you know, people who like to play different places and play with different people and enjoy the game. So it's, you know, another, you know, friendship that golf is thankfully brought my way.
Well, we had some friends, actually clients, that ran into him during the Dunhill Links Championship. They were all staying together, well, staying in the Old Course Hotel.
Mm.
And so they were coming in, he was going out. Pouring rain, as you might recall, it was delayed a day. Sunday got rained out, right. And they said he was very friendly. And then they went to breakfast, and they run into Catherine Zeta-Jones in the restaurant. And it's a great place to run into people like that, I suppose, at the Old Course Hotel during that tournament. But
yeah, that's a good one to get into for sure. That's a good place to be that week.
So I started at the beginning by saying that you had a love affair with golf. Is your love stronger for Parkland or Lynx golf?
For me, it's, you know, I would have said, like, I don't know, 5 years ago, I probably would just said Lynx golf, you know, that was the truest expression of the game. And it is. And that style of game is how golf's really supposed to be played. And it is, but I think in doing the America book and now owning a Parkland golf course or like a mountainside golf course, I guess it's parts.
Yeah.
It's not Lynx. I think I've just grown to appreciate sort of like the Golfers Journal, golf in all its forms. Like I think that you know, I wouldn't say one is better than the other. I think if you're playing Lynx golf for a couple of weeks, it's just a lot of fun to see how your game changes and how you start hitting different kinds of shots and how you really have to think your way around the golf course. But, you know, I just played desert golf last week out at you know, Wekopa, which, you know, which Bill Coren, Ben Crenshaw did. And I was like, man, this is like, maybe this is as fun as golf gets. I'm not sure. And those conditions are not, we're not super linksy at all. So I feel like I've probably evolved from like having a strong take on being a links, the links warrior that I once was. That said, I mean, I probably am over there 3 or 4 times a year. Links binging for sure, because you got to make sure you get it in.
Well, I think this past, well, what I guess 18 months ago or so, I was in Scotland with some clients and with my partner, and I hadn't played Fortrose and Rose Markey or Cullen. We played those. I've never had more fun playing golf than playing those two courses. It's just pure fun. And I think the allure for people like us that live in the States is we can't play that kind of golf here. You have to go over there basically to play that kind of golf. I guess you could go to Bandon Dunes, but I understand they've got an 18-month waiting list to get on, and I can get on virtually any course over there in some way sooner than 18 months, but
Yeah, and it's more than the golf too when you're over there. It's the whole thing, you know. It's the welcome, it's the soup afterward, it's the pint of whatever, it's the whole package that just feels like, wow, this is how you're supposed to do it. And those far flung courses that you're talking about, I mean, it doesn't get any more fun than that. I mean, Cullen is just such a blast.
Yes. We showed up one more. It was a Sunday morning. We had a 9:40 tee time. The clubhouse didn't open until 10, so we couldn't get scorecards or trolleys. So we made the decision. There were 5 of us. We emptied our bags. We decided to play a 7 club scramble. So we did, or not scramble, but a 7 hole game, 7 club game. So we didn't have to carry our bags fully loaded. And we played as a fivesome, and just every hole there is a blast. It's got to be like your course, right? In other words, you take what you've got. You take the land as it's given to you, and you present a golf course, a golf hole, the best you can with what you've got.
Absolutely, and I think that's something. You know, I was at the superintendent's conference last week in Phoenix, and I was doing a talk, and that was an idea that sort of, it kept coming up all through the week, really, this idea that, like, you know, golfers will go to Scotland or Ireland and they'll play, you know, a very natural, rugged links golf course, and they'll think, like, this is the best golf I've ever played in my life, and then come home to their country club and complain that they're, you know, that the greens are too slow and there's some dollar spot on the 13th green or something, you know what I mean? And it's like there's that disconnect, or that maybe it's a lack of sort of education, or maybe we all just get drunk on watching the Masters every April when we think about what a golf course should look like. Because what, you know, when you're playing golf in Scotland, Ireland, England, you know, you are reminded that golf is a game that you're playing outdoors, and you can't avoid, and it's supposed to be natural, and there should be a raw element to it. Right. And, you know, and rub of the green is a real thing, right? It's such a great, I think, education for me, coming back and owning a golf course. Yeah, I want our conditions to be as good as they can be. And so does every greenskeeper in Ireland and Scotland. But there's also, it's also nice to, you know, I have a team of 2. Working on the grounds. I have probably 5 or 6 machines that we use, and that's it. And because of that, I can offer you a membership at $600 for the year. And as they can do in Scotland, you know, the prices of membership at clubs over there is shockingly low.
Right.
Versus if you want perfection in your golf course and a large clubhouse and huge overhead and all that fun stuff, well, here's your $12,000 bill for the year. And that's I much prefer the other model.
I played at Scotts Craig. And you've played Scotts Craig, right?
Absolutely.
And they have, I met with the I played with the captain and then met with the general manager, and they were talking about they have four greenskeepers. Dumbarney has 42.
No, yeah.
Right? I mean, you're going to get a better presented golf course, but would you trade an experience at, say, Brora, where you've got, electrical fences around each green, you've got wild daisies in the fairway, you've got sheep and cow dung in the fairway or in the rough, it's, and don't you just find that
Never.
to
I
be
wouldn't.
like,
That's
you
why
shouldn't
you go
change
to
it.
Scotland. No,
Yeah.
that's it. Those aren't those experiences you're not going to find at home. It reminds you where the game came from. It makes you feel like you're playing, not like we a lot of times play golf, I think, in this way to sort of like avoid the land, like hit it over things and avoid all these things that were put in our way, and just almost like you're on a simulator. If the golf course can be just that perfect, right? Where there's no factors of unpredictability and everything should behave the way it's supposed to behave. But that's just not natural golf, and it's really not golf in my opinion. So I wouldn't trade the experiences I've had at Brora for anything. I mean, that's as good as it gets.
Tom, I want to take a slight sidetrack of a question here. What's your opinion of the state of the men's professional game today?
I would say that it's a pretty wild time if you like to follow drama and intrigue and all that sort of behind the scenes
Outside
craziness
the
and
ropes.
all that. There's a lot to pay attention to. It's not really my thing so much. I don't think it's really impacted my viewing. I probably watched golf for the places, like I'm always going to watch golf at Pebble Beach, and I don't care who's playing. The majors obviously are, huge weekends on my calendar, like every other serious golfer. And that's, I don't know if they've changed all that much, but I mean, I'm not, I think that like the stories that I'm interested in golf, and we do cover like the pro game in the Golfer's Journal, but we usually do it from an historical perspective or a really character-driven perspective. And so that hasn't changed. I don't think we've done anything about Liv yet. We publish stuff that, like I said, our stories are meant to be consumable in 20 years and still be relevant. And there's so much changing in pro golf right now that you're almost afraid to write about it in something that's going to come out, 6 months or 7 months from now, because who knows what things are going to look like. So it's a pretty wild time. I don't get too bummed or whatever about it. I think golf is in a really, really good place coming out, obviously coming out of COVID. There was the COVID bump, but I think that, if you go to the PGA show where I was a couple weeks ago and you look around and you're like, the thing that's driving golf now is like, are all these new avenues, like these young, like there's young energy, there's like new fashion, there's simulators, there's Pop Stroke, there's Topgolf, there's all these like different. I was talking about pro with a talking with a pro today about it, how like the avenue to being a golfer in the past was either I was a caddy or your mom or dad played golf. That was it. Now if you walked around the PGA show, you'd be like, okay, you got it. This guy got into golf because they went to Topgolf. This person liked playing the video game or the virtual thing. This person got into it for fashion. This person got into it because of the Golfer's Journal. Like, there's just so many different ways and avenues to explore golf that, I'm not, and the whether how attractive the program is or not, I don't know. It's getting a lot of clicks. I guess people care about that.
We can move on. I'm not, you and I kind of feel the same way. It's kind of a, it's It's disappointing to me to see what's going on in the pro game. It seems like a huge money grab, and I'm not a fan of Liv Goff, and I'm certainly not a fan of Jay Monahan and how he's handled Liv, and even what he did at Pebble Beach to drop the make it a signature event, drop the field to 80, cut the number of celebrities. Can't there? I'm not an old buddy-duddy, but can't a couple of things remain sacred? It seems like the Masters is sacred. I would have thought that would have remained sacred. Jack's tournament, Arnie's tournament, they're like temples to those guys. And the old clam bake. I don't have a problem with what's happening, like the spectacle at the Waste Management. That I think that's great. It's wonderful for golf, and it's great that they don't do it everywhere. But anyway, we'll move on. I want to be respectful of your time. So, what's your favorite links golf course? I know you have a soft spot for Ardglass and Carn. Are those your two favorites, or do you have another one?
No, I would say Carn would be my favorite. Ardglass is up there as well. Ardglass is like kind of a mix of like links and like cliff top seaside, it's probably a little rockier than your typical links. Links by definition, which should be basically dune land.
Right.
So now Carn would definitely be my favorite. I mean, it was a place that was built with, Eddie Hackett, moved zero land.
Yeah.
And his way of finding golf courses, including Enniskrone, which you mentioned, and
Right.
Connemara and so many others, was to go out and walk the land until he found the golf holes.
Right.
And that he did it for the right reasons to try and help these communities, these rural communities during a difficult time in for Ireland, to give them a point of pride and maybe a point of some economic growth.
Right.
Just that whole thing. I just love everything about that.
So Murray would probably number three.
Number three, it's possible. You never know. If I walked off it today, I'd say I'd put it in number three.
Yeah.
I'm really partial. I used to like be a terrified of Lahinch, just for the scars that I had there. But
I'm the same way.
man, it is like if you go hole by hole, like it's just Lahinch has it all. It's really, really, really good.
How about the back nine at Tralee?
Yeah, you can't beat the back nine at Tralee. I mean, there's holes there that will just I feel like part of me is still playing some of them. That are just beyond imagination. Tralee's phenomenal. I mean, the Southwest is just packed with great golf, but I love going up to Donegal and up to Mayo and then going up to Northern. There's so much great bold golf over there. It's hard to pick a favorite.
Well, what course would you most like to play in the world that you haven't played yet?
I'd say probably some stuff in Australia, New Zealand, Royal Melbourne, Tahiti. I haven't done that. I've been down there to play golf when I did Paper Tiger, but we weren't chasing. I was trying to qualify for the Australian tour at the time. So, didn't cross off any of those names, so no, those are high on the want to play list. I just have to figure out. It's one of those things like I think about planning a trip and maybe doing a book or a story for the journal, but then they start building another one. I think, all right, I gotta wait 3 years until that's finished. So, because I'm going one, it's like not. I'm probably going once more, and that's it. It's a long way from Philadelphia.
But how's your golf game at the moment? I mean,
Let's
if it wasn't
see.
wintertime, are you still play to a high level?
I played a bunch. I tried to play a lot during the PGA show. I hadn't, swung a club since October, then played a bunch in Florida and Phoenix. And put together a couple rounds. But it's like off season golf where, you'll hit a couple awesome shots, you'll make a couple birdies, and then you'll make like an eight. Just because you haven't played golf in a while and you're not sure. And your wedge, you can't find the center of your wedge or something. So, a little rusty right now. I think my index is like a 2 point something. But I mean, my goal this year is to get back to scratch, and actually work on some things in my swing, which I haven't. I've been tinkering, but I haven't gone far enough to really consult with the folks I need to. So I'm going to do that this year and tighten it up.
Yeah, I committed a couple of years ago to take a lesson once a week. Not that's not 50 lessons a year. It's whenever possible, I'm taking a lesson from an LPGA pro, a retired LPGA pro. I just can't tell you. I mean, for those people that think I can fix myself,
right?
It's just, I mean, having a second set of eyes, she can make an adjustment that changes your golf swing forever. I mean, one. Yeah. Anyway, I've got one last question for you. I want to be, again, respectful for your time, but you and I have traveled to over there to play a lot of links golf, but I'd love to hear for our viewers and listeners that are going over for the first time, what advice do you have for people going to play links golf for literally the first time?
Yeah, I would say, like, try and leave your expectations at home. Just have an open mind is the most, well, that's the most important thing in life, isn't it? But yeah. But it's also important for one's golf. When you're going to play links golf, it's going to be different. If you've never played links golf, it's probably going to be different than what you've experienced. So try not to judge it through the lens that you look at, you know, your golf club or country club at home. Take it for what it is, a completely new experience.
Yeah.
That is going to frustrate you but reward you and going to just be a ton of fun. I mean, from a golf perspective, yeah, I mean, links golf is more like bowling and less like darts. So it's a game you can play along the ground. You don't ever want to, you know, if you're coming into a green, don't shoot the pin, or if you do shoot the pin, like you never want to hit the ball pin high, generally, in my experience, because you'll end up over the green in the junk.
Yeah.
So that's why yardages over there are often measured to the front of the green. So that's always a nice surprise for people. And the flags will make you think everything's much farther away because they're shorter for the wind. So that's something you have to adjust to as well. So there are just some little things that golf wise, I think if you play a lot of links golf a few days in a row, you start to learn how you start, at least I can start feeling myself hitting, you know, 3/4 shots to just get the solid contact through the wind, that you're hitting lower shots. You're taking more club and sort of making sure you find the middle of the face so that you're not shooting the ball up into the wind and stuff. And so it's really fun. And links golf is, you know, it's like, you know, Dave McClay Kidd talks about this all the time, where like, you know, in our soft conditions, our garden golf experience that we often get in America, like as soon as the ball leaves the club face, the show's over. Like, you know, whether you're on the green or, you know, if you're playing high or, you know, whatever. But when links golf, the show is just beginning when it lands.
Yeah.
And that's the story is just starting to unfold.
Yeah.
And so I would say try to enjoy that. And instead of like being frustrated that you're not playing to your handicap, because you're not going to play to your handicap. Yeah. I'll just tell you right now, Scottish and English and Irish handicaps are a lot stouter. So don't get any too many matches either, because you're going to lose with your American handicap.
Yeah. Well, I find the other thing that's interesting, Tom, is that if you take a caddy, which I highly recommend because of the stories and the, I mean, getting to meet a local, but it's interesting how within two holes they're handing you the right club.
Yeah, for sure.
And you've been with people who don't agree with their caddy. No, I need to hit a 7-iron here, and they're going, no, you need to hit a 6-iron or a 9-iron or whatever. And
yeah, listen to your caddy. I should say, if you have a good caddy and the wind is down, you can play to your handicap. You can play better than your handicap because you know, wind is a links defense, but. But don't be worried too much about score, because frankly, as you know, Jeff, that's why they play Stableford over there and everything, right?
Right.
All the tournaments over there are Stableford, because if you're playing in a links, you're probably gonna lose a ball here and there. You know, something's gonna happen, and you're gonna have an X on your card, and that's okay.
Yeah, I agree. Finally, Tom, where can people find and follow you?
Absolutely. So, on the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, I'm at CoinWriter, COYNE. They can go to TomCoin.com to find out to be in touch or reach out. So social media and thegolfersjournal.com. Please do check out the Golfers Journal, and you can find a lot of my writing there, along with a lot of other great folks. And of course, any of the books, wherever books are sold, check them out.
Yeah, I want to encourage everyone. Tom's been generous with his time, and I really am a fan. I've read all the books. I read the Golfers Journal. I listen to the podcast. Like you, I consume a lot of golf material. And like you, I prefer to read non-golf when I'm not, when I'm on vacation. I take, you know, mystery novels and murder novels and things like that. Sure. But I really want to encourage everyone to subscribe to the Golfers Journal. Joining that Broken Tee is just amazing. The gifts that we get, the access to the website and the journal itself is just fantastic. So
thank you, Jeff.
I should mention
the Broken Tee Society, because you'd asked earlier where that came from. The subscribers, the members, created the Broken Tee Society themselves. They started referring to themselves as the Broken Tee Society because our logo is a broken tee, and so that grew organically, and it's just been very, very cool to watch.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, not just for your time, but more importantly, for the gift that you've given all of us that are golfers. Your writing, the stories, you know, they've inspired me to take different trips and to play different courses. And I know that anyone who reads your books are going to feel that way, particularly the last three. So thanks so much for all that you do for the game of golf.
Thank you, Jeff. It was great being here, and I hope our paths cross soon.
I hope so. Thanks.
Really appreciate you staying on for this podcast. If you enjoyed it, like and share this video. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and follow on our podcast channels to see when the next podcast goes live. Thank you so much.